Make no mistake, we are in the early innings, I think, of a gold and gold stock bull market that will be one for the records. It won't be stair steps to heaven. It won't be straight up. This market's volatile. Andy, people with a sense of humor might be surprised to know that in that great bull market of the 1970s, when the gold price went from $35 to $850, in the middle of that decade in 1975, the gold price fell by half. So when I say there's going to be a gold bull market, there is, and it's going to test you. And if you don't meet the test,
Rick Rule, good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
fine, Andy. The better for being on with you. Thank you for inviting me back.
It is absolutely my pleasure. Let's start out with the macro landscape here. It's really teeing up. Well, actually, let me take a couple steps back. I had you on in January, and you gave such a great speech at one of the venues that you speak at, and it was critical of investors that really things are right in front of them if they just have the courage and start taking advantage of the time. Talk a little bit about go back, talk a little bit about that and where are we at in this cycle. There's so many wonderful things for natural resource stocks to be excited and optimistic about.
Well, make no mistake, we are in the early innings, I think, of a gold and gold stock bull market that will be one for the records. It won't be stair steps to heaven. It won't be straight up. This market's volatile. Andy, people with a sense of humor might be surprised to know that in that great bull market of the 1970s, when the gold price went from $35 to $850, in the middle of that decade in 1975, the gold price fell by half. So when I say there's going to be a gold bull market, there is, and it's going to test you. And if you don't meet the test, it's going to kick your ass. If you are prepared for this bull market, you're going to make an absolutely ferocious amount of money, but you have to be prepared for it. People say to me now, "Is it over, Rick?" And I answer that question by saying to them, "Here's what would make me sell my gold. Until the circumstances that would cause me to sell my gold are intact, I think the bull market's intact. And here's the circumstances. Because gold does well when people are concerned about the maintenance of their purchasing power in fiat currency denominated instruments. We would have to see a balanced federal budget. That's one. Two, we would have to have a feasible plan for paying back $30 trillion in debt. Three, we would have to deal with entitlement deficits, the net present value of our financial promises to old folks like me exceeds $100 trillion. And we'd have to have a plan to deal with the net present value of entitlement liabilities. We already know you aren't going to get yours. The question is, of course, for everybody else and how that gets paid for. And then the third thing, or the fourth thing, pardon me, is I would need to see real interest rates. And I need to explain that. If you believe that the deterioration in the purchasing power of the US dollar is measured by the CPI, then you believe the inflation rate in the United States is 2.5%. That doesn't relate to the inflation that I have experienced in the goods and services that I buy. When I look at the deterioration of the purchasing power of my savings, I think the US inflation rate is more like 7.5%. The real interest rate, as I define it, is the difference between the interest rate paid to me by the US 10-year Treasury, 4.5%, and the rate of deterioration of the purchasing power of my dollar, 7.5%. I believe that the real interest rate is a negative 3%. And for me to sell my gold, I would have to see a positive real interest rate. If you think about the economic ramifications of a positive interest rate, if you believe my assertion that the deterioration of the purchasing power of the US dollar is 7.5% a year, that would suggest that the 10-year rate would have to be 9.5%, it would suggest that the 30-year mortgage rate would have to be 10.5 or 11, rates that we haven't seen since the decade of the 1970s. For all of those reasons, the reasons that would cause me to sell my gold seem to me to be very remote. And I'll put that into a context that isn't personal. In the decade of the 1970s, according to the Congressional Budget Office, not some fat old libertarian crank named Rick Rule, the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar declined over 10 years by 75%. That is, that $1,000 1980 bought you $250 worth of 1970s goods and services. And I think that's precisely what happens for the next 10 years. We reduce the nominal value of the $100 trillion in off-balance sheet liabilities by reducing the real value by 75%. I don't think it's a coincidence, Andy, that in the decade of the 70s, when the U.S. dollar lost 75% of its purchasing power, that the gold price went up 30-fold. I'm not suggesting to you that the gold price is going to go up 30-fold. It's already up 12-fold since the year 2000. What I am suggesting is that it's more likely than not that the increase in the gold price more or less reflects the deterioration in the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. I'm not suggesting that anybody put 100% of their net worth in gold or gold stocks. I'm just suggesting that with the mean market share of precious metals and precious metals related assets in the United States being 0.5%, there's room in most portfolios for a substantial addition to gold and gold stocks. And if the mean market share of precious metals and precious metals related securities returns to its 40-year average, the market share of precious metals and precious metals related securities in the U.S. market will go from 0.5% to 2%, a fourfold increase. Imagine the impact on price that a fourfold increase in demand would have.
Yeah, astronomical. Work through with me a little bit, and to all my viewers and listeners, we're going to talk about a handful of stocks here that we like, but I really don't know if that's really helpful to you as an end user for somebody that's viewing this. What's really helpful is something that you just said is preparation and education about the sector, because what's the old proverb? If you fish, you're going to fish. Yeah. You feed them for a day, but if you teach them how to fish, they'll fish for a lifetime. And that's so true, especially in this sector. Stocks will go up and down. You and I both, I have many, many battle stories of things I lost on. Don't concentrate all of your wealth in one company because Andy Mallett said it, or four companies that Andy Mallett said it, or Rick Rule said it. You really need to do a lot of great due diligence, as well as just, yeah, invest in yourself is really what I'm trying to say here. But let's start with your methodology here about how you start scaling in and then how you start educating yourself. I myself will start to nibble on some names that I like. And then hope is a bad word, but hope that they go down. That's very counterintuitive to what a lot of people, how they play this sector. Comment about that, about your methodology.
I think the first thing that you do is you sit down with yourself on a Sunday or Sunday when you have time, and you assess yourself. What are your goals? How much risk can you tolerate? How much volatility, which is different, can you tolerate? Mm-hmm. What are you trying to accomplish and what your time frames are? If your time frames are short, you leave the sector. You go somewhere else. You do something else. Because if your time frames are short, the narrative, the strategy around natural resource investing is 5 or 6 or 7 year strategy. And if you try to employ a 3-month tactic in a 7-year game, you're going to lose money. The second thing is calibrate your greed. What you find in a gold bull market, if you look at past markets, what you find is the trough to peak, the market beta itself, I would define beta as the extent to which gold equities outperform the broad equities markets. the beta is 250, 350, 400%. For most people, Andy, most people, for the overwhelming majority of people, they would be better served buying the best of the best gold companies, participating in the beta, maybe even underperforming beta a little bit, but removing all the operating risk. Buy the Franco-Nevadas, buy the Wheatons, buy the Agnico Eagles, the very, very, very best. Participate in the market beta, maybe make a little less money than they would make it with an ETF, but screen out all the companies that had operating risk. 90% of investors would be better off doing that, but they won't. If you are willing to subject yourself to volatility and risk, precious metals bull markets follow a very predictable path. The metal moves first. The best of the best move next. The second best move third. The best of the rest move fourth. The developers, the single asset companies, move fifth, and the explorers move sixth. You can move down the value chain, looking for relative value, ahead of the whip, and you can do extraordinarily well. But you have to be willing to work. You have to be willing to work hard. We ask speculators to limit the number of speculations in their portfolio to the number of hours per month they're willing to work, understanding their portfolio. That does not mean listening to Rick Rule and Andy Mollett. It means reading resource reports, reading insider filings, reading quarterly reports, reading proxies. If you're willing to spend 10 hours a month, own 10 stocks. If you aren't willing to work, own less risky stocks. And as you suggested, your first investment should be in yourself. I selfishly suggest that the place you start is the Rule Classroom. It's very cheap. In fact, it's free. We have a couple hundred hours of programming there, including about 10 hours of instructional programming called Introduction to Natural Resource Investing. You get a primer there as to how to know what you need to know to invest and speculate in natural resources. If in sitting down with yourself, you determine that you're not interested enough to teach yourself how to invest and not willing to work hard enough to put those lessons into practice, you should go find something else to do, because this place will punish you.
Yes, it will. And I said that from experience. I've made so many mistakes in that. That being said, yes, I would start with the Rule Classroom. That is a great place to start, just to start. And that's not a finish, just getting knowledge, if you would. The second thing I've been doing it for years, is actually going to the company's websites and look at the financial reports. In your evaluation process, what do you like to see in a company that makes you want to buy them? Just give two or three things that you look for.
I like the company to state their goals very clearly. And I like to look at the goals they stated this year relative to the goals they stated last year and see whether they made any progress in achieving them. In other words, were the goals public relations, or were they real goals, and were they achieved? I like to compare the goals with management's track record at the task at hand. Let's say that the company is involved in exploring for copper-gold porphyries in 15-year-old accreted terrain in Spanish-speaking Peru. But the management's background was producing rather than exploring Archean gold, 2-billion-year-old gold, in French-speaking Quebec. The management's skill sets aren't aligned with the task at hand. I like to look at how they spent money. I found, to my chagrin, that in the junior sector, more than half the companies spend more than half the capital raised on general and administrative expense. I like to see G&A less than 25% of total capital raised, preferably less than 15%. It's a risky enough business if the money goes in the ground. It's a really risky business if the money doesn't go in the ground. And more often than not, Andy, it doesn't go in the ground, which is a guarantee of failure. When the company has expressed its goals, I like to ask them, or I like them to tell me, how much money it is expected to cost to test their thesis. And how much will it cost to keep the company alive while the thesis is being tested? And I like to juxtapose that with how much money they have. Let's say that the company's thesis is that this drilling program will confirm a wonderful soil anomaly that has already been trenched. We know that the anomaly, you know, goes to bedrock, hasn't been transported. And let's say that the drilling program, because it's in the north, will take two drilling seasons, 18 months. And let's say it'll cost $5 million. Let's say, too, that it costs the company $2 million a year in G&A to stay alive. So there's $5 million in drilling, $2 million in this year's G&A, and $500,000 in the next 6 months' G&A. That means it's going to cost them $6.5 million to answer the unanswered question. Okay, you look on the balance sheet and you see that they only have $700,000 cash left. How are they going to answer the unanswered question when it requires $6.5 million and they only have $700,000? That's the kind of thing I like to see. I also like to see companies where the guys running the company are my partners. I want to see most of the accretion of wealth for them occur through shares that they've paid for at prices similar to the prices that I've paid, not because they put together the company at a penny. Mm-hmm. And I like to see the paid for value of the stock they own be 5 times the amount of their annual salary and bonus.
I'm taking notes. So one of the questions, and you probably already answered it, is really on the board, on the executive team, how important is it to you to have a person, I would say a banker, but a person on the board or on the executive team that has access or can raise capital? Because most of these companies have a hard time raising capital, in my mind.
Capital markets experience is critical. And mercifully, if you have high-quality technical people, capital markets experience isn't hard to find. There are a whole lot of guys of my vintage or slightly younger than me that have experienced success a couple times before and don't want to run a company again. Mm-hmm. But they do want to back somebody who does run a company. Mm-hmm. But having a CFO, as an example, who has presided over capital raises before, and by the way, has also written checks for exploration campaigns so that he or she knows how to manage the money that they've already raised. And having somebody on the board who provides adult supervision with regards to capital raises is important. Too many companies, in an attempt, I think, to raise the share price and their options, play just in time with capital, which is to say they want to raise the capital when they need it. You raise the capital when it's available. Mm-hmm. And that's important. And not all capital is the same. In a good market, most companies want to consign responsibility for raising capital to Canaccord or Haywood or Sprott. Wrong. That's your responsibility. What will happen with the investment banks is that they will tell you an optimistic story to get a retainer and an upfront fee. And then they'll throw the story against the wall and see if it sticks. If the money comes back, they'll take the fee. If the money doesn't come back, it's too bad, so sad. Strong letter to follow. The responsibility for capital raising lies with the company.
Got it. Okay, so let's take this here and really push forward to what you have going on into July. And you have the 2025 Rural Investment Symposium. It's very interesting to me and me talking to my listeners and viewers here. This can be, not necessarily, but it can be life-changing if you do it right. I'm not speaking for Rick here. This is how I have handled these in the past, and I've been to many conferences. It's number one, be prepared. Start doing research now before you get there, not just, hey, take a bunch of brochures or what slicks or whatever when you get there, but start doing your due diligence now and start asking those questions. But I think really the biggest and best value I've ever gotten out of a conference, whether that's yours or somebody else's, is not only meeting the companies and talking to them, but more importantly is the conversations and the relationships I've built.
Yep.
During and after walking the halls, talking to the likes of you or other very successful investors, watching what they do and listening to what questions they ask. Comment about that and talk to me about the 2025 rule symposium.
Well, that's very prescient. You get out of it what you put into it. Let's start with who shouldn't come. If you buy the Sunday paper for the crossword puzzles and the funnies, don't come. This is not an entertainment event. We're going to present between 50 and 55 hours of very dense, very valuable programming. And if you aren't prepared to absorb that plus, don't come. This is an investment in yourself. I've for 30 years tried to deal with what I call the tyranny of time, which is to say we have more knowledge to impart in 55 hours than any human being can absorb. So we've dealt with the tyranny of time by cheating. I interview every single public company exhibitor before the conference. Those interviews are published at the Rule Investment Media website and at the Rule Classroom. Review as many of those companies before the conference as you can. To the extent that a company really interests you, reach out before the conference to the company. Download their financial information from Edgar or CDAR. Arrive prepared. Listen to the pre-conference interviews that I do with the speakers. Determine which speakers that you need to hear and which you can afford to miss in order to do other things. When you're at the conference, every night, every single night, write down what you learned during the day. We're going to give you more information than you can remember. It'll be fresh in your mind in the morning, but by the next morning, something else will be fresh in your mind. You keep it fresh in your mind by keeping it in writing so that you can come back to it. Understand, too, that the conference is meant to be consumed in conjunction with the lessons at the Rule Classroom, which are free. In particular, the lessons in the section Introduction to Natural Resource Investing, where there are hours of how-to programming about analyzing natural resource investments. And then remember, after the conference, that discussion groups will take place at the Rule Classroom, where you can compare notes on a variety of topics with many other investors. The point that you make about other attendees is valuable, too. Between in-person and online, there will be thousands of people there. The idea that all of the knowledge emanates from the dais to the room is silly. There's lots of knowledge, lots of applied knowledge in the room. A guy emailed me about 8 years ago. He said, Rick, following first Robert Friedland and then Ross Beaty around your exhibit floor and seeing what booths those billionaires stopped in front of and occasionally listening to the questions they asked was worth more than the price of admission. I got the rest of the conference for free, which is a pretty good price. So now let me talk about the conference itself and what you're going to get and what you're going to need to absorb. We have the best big picture macro of any conference I know of, despite the fact that we're not a macro conference. And we do that by limiting the conference macro speakers to those people who have real world experience in the subjects that they discuss. We don't get influencers talking about macro. We don't get journalists talking about macro. The discussion of the debt, the deficit, and the U.S. economy will be David Stockman, who presided over the Department of Government Efficiency in its original form. In the Reagan years, he ran the Office of Management and Budget. And he can describe the derailment of America by politics in a way nobody else can, because he speaks, in a biblical sense, from the belly of the beast. We move on to the Fed. Really contentious topic today. We don't have a failed journalism person talking about it. We have Daniela DiMartino Booth, who was a Fed analyst, a Fed researcher. We move from there to Wall Street, where we have Noemi Prinz, a former partner at Goldman Sachs. Again, not a journalist, but a player. Jim Rickards talks about the corrupt intersection between Wall Street and government. He does that as the former counsel to long-term capital management, whose failure almost brought down Wall Street. Once we've established the world the way it is, as opposed to the way that the big media thinks it should be, we take you to what to do about it. We take you to portfolio managers and analysts who come from natural resource backgrounds, not failed crypto guys, not failed tech guys, but rather people who've made money where the rubber meets the road in resources in good markets and bad for 3 or 4 decades. Importantly, every single one of our exhibitors is vetted. If the conference sponsors don't own shares, the exhibitors don't get on our floor. We turn down more exhibitors every year than we admit, which is important. Our attendees have told us for 30 years that the exhibitors are content. So they're content. That's the way it is. We have the Living Legends, which is my favorite session, where people who have built multi-billion dollar natural resource companies from scratch tell you how they did it, tell you the mistakes they made, tell you how the process made them better investors, tell you how you can become better investors. Importantly, tell you the attributes that allow somebody to take a $20 million company to $3 billion or $4 billion or $5 billion. Put all that together, the interviews before, the conversations after, the preparation at the Rule Classroom as to how to do this, the macro, the analysts, the Living Legends, the vetted exhibitors, that allows me to make a promise that nobody else makes. If you attend the conference, either live, which I would prefer, or via live stream, by the way, last year, 33 countries participated via live stream, and you think for any reason that I haven't delivered your tuition's worth, I'll give you your money back. Absolute satisfaction or your money cheerfully refunded. Mercifully, in 30 years of making that promise, I've had to refund less than 1/10 of 1% of the tuitions I've charged. But that's because that guarantee makes the product work. And the product will work for you, provided you put into it yourself.
Got it. Yeah, for all of our viewers, there you go. It is probably one of, if not the best values I see there. And this is me trying to be objective, that I see there out there in the marketplace. So let's get more specific here. Let's review a couple of companies. Full disclosure, I'll tell you which ones I'm invested in. I want your thoughts, if you can give me. Let me know if you're invested in them or not. Please, to all of our viewers and listeners, this is not a waiver to not do your own due diligence. You have to do your own diligence. These are just some companies that I see should potentially be on your radar. This is not me. I have skin in the game with some of these companies, but this is not me just going off the cuff on them. One of them is Heliostar. I've become very familiar with them. I've talked to the CEO on my show, Charles Funk, numerous times. I love their project, and I love that the war chest that they have in. They have a ton of money, and they have what seems to be a great asset. I talked to Charles. How did you get this asset? And he made a great anecdote. He said, "Buy straw hats in winter. That's how we did it." What's your thoughts on Heliostar?
Well, I'm a huge Charles Funk fan, going back decades. In fact, he's my vintage, and I guess that's something you need to be concerned about. I don't own Heliostar. I missed it originally. I like the exploration results. I like Charles. My only criticism might be in terms of data and size. I think this is likely to become a mine. I'm not so sure it becomes a good mine. I wouldn't discourage Heliostar because, as I say, I've watched Charles Funk for a very long time. He isn't trying to use this to get rich. He's rich. You don't have to worry about him selling stock before he attains his goals because he doesn't have to make a Mercedes payment. He's playing for all the marbles, which I really, really, really like, but I don't own it.
All right. Let's talk about Go Gold. I am not an investor in Go Gold, but I'm very familiar with them. I'm potentially going to be an investor in Go Gold, not because of what you say, but just doing my own due diligence. What are your own thoughts?
I'm a large investor in Go Gold. I've known these people for a long time. I believe from a geological point of view, they haven't found a mine, they found a camp. two or three mines. I think it's amusing that despite the fact that I urged them not to go into the tailings reprocessing business, they ignored my advice. They did, and they fund more than all of their G&A and have money left over from something I thought was a mistake. I think they are at that point in exploration now where it's become predictive. They understand enough about the genesis of the deposit that when they develop a thesis and test it with the drill bit, it turns out that the drill bit is predictive. I've seen this happen 30 times before in my career, and this is normally transformative. This is the period when you add ounces, when you understand how the material was put in place, where to look for it, and how to find it, and they're there. Challenges, to be sure. Mexico is politically challenging, and where they are is sociologically challenging. My belief is that the geology is profound enough that they overcome those challenges. And I suspect in this cycle, what likely happens is that GoGold gets taken over. Note, I am a shareholder. I was a shareholder in Gammon, their prior effort. I made a lot of money, which attracted me to this team.
Okay, let's talk about Power Nickel. And to all my viewers, not Power Nickel, Power Metal. It used to be Power Nickel. I am an investor in Power. I know Terry Lynch pretty well. He is a very charismatic CEO, and I believe has done a lot for the industry. I also believe in their asset. Tell me what your thoughts are on Power Metal.
I'm not a Power shareholder. I am similarly a fan of Terry. This is a very big asset. I think it has grade challenges, and I think it has CapEx challenges. So I'm not a shareholder. I think that we won't see a real nickel bull market for 2 or 3 years. And I myself look for higher grade and lower capital intensity. I look for better net present value relative to upfront capital expense. But the market will ultimately pay for a Canadian deposit. They will ultimately pay for a big deposit, and they will ultimately pay for Terry. If you want nickel optionality, it'd be tough to find a better name. That's not what I want. I have other nickel names that are higher grade and lower capital intensity than Power.
Got it. There's one that I found on the 2025 Rule Symposium portal, if you would. It was new to me. Talk a little bit. I hope I get this name right. Fiora Gold Group. Tell me a little bit about
it. Fiora is the group of companies that operate under the sponsorship of Frank Giustra. I've known Frank Giustra virtually my whole life. I have been his customer. He has been my customer. I have been a competitor of his. I've been a cooperator of his. I've had several fine dinners with him and great conversations. He's an amazing human being. A boy from the wrong side of the track, whose dad was a miner, who became likely a billionaire in mining. When he got bored of mining, he built one of the world's largest motion picture companies. Truly a stellar human being. He likes backing good people through thick and thin. The last time I interviewed him, I asked him, what was your success? He says, I never quit. I just love that. I never quit. Frank will have failures. He will have successes. But his successes will never be for want of trying. He finds very good people who are trying to build real companies. And when Frank built Yorkton Securities, it took him 15 years. When he built what is now Wheaton Precious Metals as a spinoff of Wheaton River, it took him 10 years. When he merged Wheaton River with Goldcorp and built what is now Newmont, it took him 15 years. But he did it. And I'm not trying to say he did it on his own. He would tell you he didn't. But he was, how would you say, he was the gray eminence, the guy in the back who applied adult supervision, the guy who said no to stupid decisions, the guy who found the money for good decisions.
Got it. So to all my viewers and listeners, three of these are going to be at the symposium. Correct me if I'm wrong, Rick. Heliostar is not. I am an investor in Power. I'm an investor in Heliostar. I am not an investor, but a very wanting to invest in GoGold. as well as Fiori. I hope I get that right. Gold Group. So thank you for that. Let's pivot a little bit to the theme of buying straw hats in winter. So gold, and rightfully so, and I agree with you 100% that this is the beginning, not the end, but it will be a stair step, and it might be, we might have levels, well, we are going to have levels of volatility, but also we're going to have some deep corrections. Guys, that's just how markets are. That's just how they are. And that's a good thing. But what are some sectors here that you would see that are not getting the love or need to get more love that you are interested in? And I don't want to speak for you again, but I'm really, I have a list of uranium companies and I have a list of oil and gas companies. Well, specifically oil, because it seems to be so hated and undervalued now. What do you see as a sector that needs more love from you?
Well, the best of the extractive sectors by business has always been the oil and gas business. It's the best business there. And obviously one would concentrate one's capital in the best business. It is also, as you suggest, hated, which is great. A good company, a good sector that's cheap. You need to be patient in the oil business. I am not an economist, but I believe that we're in the early stages of an economic slowdown, and oil is an economically sensitive item. I believe that the oil industry in its length and breadth in the United States is selling for half what it's worth. So I believe that the discount is enough to accommodate for the time value of money. And I believe that most investors in the United States, given how little effort most of them will put into it, should probably buy Exxon and call it a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the best of the best is cheap. If you're willing to take more risk, and particularly if you're willing to take political risk, go north of the border. Those companies are selling for 2/3 of U.S. metrics, and the U.S. is cheap. Your risk there is Mr. Carney, the prime minister, who is suddenly making pro-energy noises. Now, he's a politician. His lips are moving. That means he's probably lying. But if you are willing to take him at his word, the Canadian oil and gas sector is going to rip. Notice I did not say the Canadian oil and gas sector is going to rip. I said it's selling for way less than it's worth. And if you take the Canadian leader at his word, then the oil and gas industry up there is going to absolutely rip. We haven't come into an oil and gas bull market yet. We may be 2 years away. We may be 3 years away. But the industry as a whole is now underspending on sustaining capital investments to the extent of $1.5 billion U.S. dollars per day. This under expenditure constrains production 2 years out, 3 years out, 4 years out. It just flat does. In a capital-intensive business, if you don't spend the capital, you don't have the business. That's the way it goes. Markets always work. So the soft equities prices in oil and gas, the increased interest charges in oil and gas, which is to say the cost of capital, and the underinvestment in sustaining capital investments guarantees a bull market in oil and gas. It just does. I can't tell you when. But that's just the way math works.
Right.
I like palladium and platinum because they've been out of favor for a very long time. And because there's been an artificial increase in supply in the palladium and platinum business. Like 1990 and 1991, when the Russians need money, they sell what's on the shelf. For those of you who haven't noticed, their ammo bill's pretty big. And they have dishoarded platinum and palladium, them being the largest or second largest producer of platinum and palladium. When the Russians run out of inventory to sell, including new mined inventory, the prices boom like they did in 1993. We're coming to that point in Russia. They've spent the free cash flow on a war, not on sustaining capital at Norilsk, and they will run out of inventory. That's just the way these things work. Meanwhile, the stuff is too cheap. And nobody cares. So I'm attracted to platinum and palladium. Will it be this year? I don't know. If you're a technical guy, apparently the charts tell you that. I'm not a technical guy, but the technical guys are real horny about platinum, for what that's worth. I love the rare earths business because the market hates them. The markets don't understand them. There is zero doubt in my mind that the cost of producing rare earths in China is going up rapidly, because the Chinese are beginning to adhere to rational environmental policies in far western China where they produce the stuff. Meanwhile, it's become weaponized. They don't want to sell us the stuff, particularly when it goes into our weaponry. and we don't want to be reliant on them. So non-Chinese rare earth deposits will be worth a lot more 5 years from now than they are now. Right now, because it hasn't worked for the last 3 or 4 years, nobody cares. But I do. I'm attracted to nickel, although I think it's early on nickel. I don't have the guts to buy nickel optionality now. I have the guts to buy grade in sulfide nickel, where deposits today, where they put in production, would be in the best quartile worldwide of sustaining cap. So I'm, you know, I'm more interested in names like Centaurus, you know, sulfide nickel deposits, other places. What else? That's sort of it. That's a lot of different things I like. You know, what I particularly like, Andy, are trifectas. So I like tier one deposits, $10 or $20 billion in in situ recoverable reserves and resources, in deposit types that people don't like, in countries that people don't like. I love, as you know, Andy, hate. A commodity that people either dislike or are bored of or hate is good. In a country that people can't spell, can't pronounce, dislike or hate, on top of that is good, particularly when it's a large deposit and where the market hasn't moved. We'll have three of those companies at the symposium. I'm not suggesting any of them will ever work, but I am suggesting that when I look back in the course of my career, 10 baggers, 20 baggers, 30 baggers, 40 baggers, buying tier one deposits in out-of-favor commodities, often in countries that other people were afraid of, has been the stuff that gave me things like Tanki Mining, 19 cents to $19. And despite the fact that I don't need one, I want one.
So, thank you. Comment a little bit about, I think, one of the issues investors, and I count myself in that group, have is knowing when to sell. And I remember a story, I don't remember if this was on camera or not, our good friend Doug Casey and you both would buy and sell. This was, I want to say, during the 80s or the 90s, the different, when a company would rip, you would take profits. And by the way, I'm having Doug on next week. He was scheduled. I'll give him your regards.
Nobody better than Doug.
What a great mind. But comment about that, because a lot of people, they'll get, you know, two times, three times their money, and then they won't sell. What are your thoughts on that? Do you just hold on, or do you hold on for the 10 times, or when to take profits?
I do a couple different things. As an investor, I'm extremely patient. And as an investor, I look at the juxtaposition between price and value. If I think that something is selling for half what it's worth, I buy. If I think something is becoming overpriced relative to what it's worth, unless I think it'll be worth a lot more for some reason 3 or 4 years from now, I sell. It's all about the juxtaposition of price to value. In a different portion of my portfolio, I'm a speculator. Mm-hmm. So 6 months ago, even 4 months ago, everywhere you looked on social media, if you punched in uranium, you found hate. Much like 3 years ago in the silver juniors, you found hate. In that circumstance where you have an extreme, extreme sentiment, I buy for trading. And I'm delighted to say in the last 4 months, the uranium stocks are up uniformly 35 and 40%. I've sold the positions I bought because they were oversold. There was some that I bought because I thought that they'd get a 30 or 40% bounce when the hate receded. That happened. So I sold them. Relative to my overall uranium position, it's not a big position. I probably sold 10, 12% of my holdings, but I bought, you know, I added that holding precisely for this set of circumstances. What you're going to start to see in a bull market, Andy, a year from now, 2 years from now, is in the exploration sector, I will buy a stock because I think that they're going to answer an unanswered question. And I think they'll answer it 18 months from now. And I think the consequence of the answer, if it's a yes, that the stock will triple. And sometimes you have a circumstance in a bull market where in anticipation of the answer, the stock triples. before you get the data, I sell those. Or at least I sell enough to get the rest for free. Because for me, life is all about the juxtaposition between price and value, or price and expected value. Mercifully for me, I'm competing against a lot of people who are too lazy to figure out what value is. And that means that perturbations in price shake them out of their security for no reason whatsoever, other than their own psychology.
Mm-hmm. You know, you brought up something just now, speculative versus investments. And I tried to look at it as two different buckets. I have a bucket for long holding, if you would, a bucket that, I believe gold is going to whatever price, this company will do well, and I'll hold that, or I'll do some other things, meaning which I won't get into. And then I have a bucket where, hey, this has just gotten beaten down. It's really hard not to go up. And I'm going to let it rip, and I'll take profits at 30%, 50%, 100% or whatever. So I operate in, I guess my terminology would be buckets. Another thing that you mentioned that I want to point out to all of my listeners and viewers here is you monitor social media, and if it's getting a lot of love or a sector is getting a lot of love, that is, in my mind, a sell sign. I go back, I want to say it was 97 or 98. I was in the markets, and The Economist had a picture of an oil well. And you can Google this. And I want to say the headline was "A Wash in Oil." That was the bottom. So using that, talk a little bit about that. It can be either social media or mainstream media as really a counter of what's really going to happen. Talk a little bit about that.
I think that's critical. Back when I used to own a brokerage firm, Andy, any day that I had a plurality of buy tickets of 5-1, I'd sell something. Any day I had a plurality of sell tickets, 5-1, I'd buy something. And you can roughly do that on social media. When people who had uranium as a component of their handle on X went anti-uranium, no brainer. You buy uranium. When people came out of the weeds in support of uranium, it means that all the buyers in the world were already there. So you sell uranium. That one's simple. But you said something more important before that, which is to say, in your own mind. You see, what you've done, Andy, is in 20 years, you've developed a mind. You have defined yourself as an investor. You have become an investor with part of your capital. You've become a speculator or a trader, a hate trader, with some more of your capital. You've done the work that is necessary for you to take the information that's presented to you and make money on it. Most people never do that. Most people focus on the company before they focus on themselves. And not having focused on themselves, they'll never get the company right except for by accident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. So we got maybe just a couple of minutes here.
Actually, I need to go. I need to sign off. I've got an errand that I must run that I needed to attend to a few minutes ago.
Got it. Well, Rick, I'll let you go. I want to just thank you so much for your time. I'll put all of the links in the show notes. It's always very educational and very enjoyable for me. And I will see you in Florida. I can't wait.
I look forward to hosting you in Boca Raton. Thank you for this opportunity to talk.
Take care.